As part of the Scottish FA's UEFA A licence course, Scott Gemmell, Shelley Kerr and Steve Keane joined myself, Greg Patterson, for a question and answer session with the A licence participants. We pick the conversation up with Shelley telling us how she's dealt with things during the coronavirus pandemic.
I'm going to be honest, I think it's been really difficult. I think that as much as globally there's a lot of things happening, a lot of, you know, people are suffering, I think that what we have to be mindful of is that football is more than just a passion, and it's your job as well, and it's what makes you tick. So I found it really quite tough, if I'm being honest, and I've tried to stay focused and think of, you know, getting that bit clarity when the games can return, when it's safe. But I found it really challenging, I have to be honest.
Yeah. Scott, you'll be very similar to Shelley in that international manager, games that have been cancelled, and those difficulties maybe Shelley's talking about there, you've faced as well.
Yeah, exactly the same. On a kind of day-to-day business basis, I've been quite busy with Marky, the performance directors. Had quite a lot of initiatives going on. And on a social platform, my life's been no different because I'm very unsociable and I always stay in anger.
Steve, you're the opposite end of the scale though. Down in London, as you live down there, you're a sociable man. You want to get out and about and have a pint.
Well, I think there's that aspect for sure. You miss, I think, contact with people. But, you know, I echo what Shelley says. You know, there's a bigger picture, and I found it difficult. More so not seeing games. You know, I don't mind watching games on TV, but I really like watching games live and even games at training grounds. I go to a lot, you know, I'm fortunate where I am in the world. There's a lot of training grounds here where you can get in and see other games, and that's the way I relax. I like going and watching games. So the fact that you've not been allowed into training grounds and seen any matches live and then obviously mixing with people, I think's been tough, but it gives you a different type of headspace to sort out, you know, when we all start back, maybe, you know, going through all your session planners, going through all your notes and, you know, your diaries, and, you know, I'm a big note taker, so it's given me plenty of time to catch up on all that.
Yeah, good. And maybe the notes, maybe it leads us into the first question from, we've kind of got a couple of questions about how, maybe advice for the guys on the course about how to get a job. And the first one here from Seb Bowles is, you know, if you're applying for a job, what do you think the key points to maybe get across, Steve? Have you kind of any clues to that, having looked through all your notes?
Yeah, well, you know, any time I've ever been in that position, or any time I've been on the flip side where I've been sitting in interviews, maybe hiring staff, I think when you're the person, the staff member who's hiring somebody, you know, more so when I was interviewing academy staff or, you know, trying to really recruit other coaches, I think it, for Seb, trying to, what's going to be the thing that makes you stand out for the next person who's going to come in? You know, what is your superpower, as Steve Salas calls it? What are you going to get across to the panel that's interviewing you that's going to make you stand out? And really, when you walk out the door, everybody to turn round to each other and say, wow, you know, he or she, wow, they blew me away by just, you know, giving something different that not some, the next person that's going to have just, you know, a robot, as you call it. We don't produce robots in the programme. What's going to jump out and hit the panel right in between the eyes? That's what I would say. Yeah. That's the main thing.
Shelley, you'd be thinking along the same lines, would you? Something that a kind of unique selling point?
Yeah, I mean, I speak about this all the time, that you, how do you set yourself apart as a coach and a manager? Because there's lots of people got the same coaching qualifications, the same life experience, the same playing experience. So, I mean, for me, and everyone's got a passion for the game that we love, football. And I think that's clear and evident to see. But I think for me, what employers look for clubs, whether that's a club or a national association, is a clear picture in terms of how you want to play the game. They look for structure and how you can implement processes and frameworks within football, because football isn't just about coaching, it's about managing and leading people as well. So for me, it's about, you know, marrying up the process and the outcome, but we're having a clear vision on how you want to play football. I know when I went for the job that I'm currently in just now, I actually produced a document on how I'd done a quick audit on what was already happening in the women's game and how we can improve it. And I think that giving clarity in what your ideas are and your vision is quite an important thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Scott, you maybe be able to speak from your role, as you've alluded to earlier, in the performance department. Maybe, you know, as Shelley said, they're at the Scottish FA, you know, looking maybe from the other side and employing staff, as well as maybe being able to give some pointers to Seb on his question about what people might look for at interview.
Yeah, I think it's great advice from Shelley and Steve. I think you just got to get that balance right, haven't you, between being yourself, being prepared, being confident. I think the confidence comes through your preparation and then trying to have as much influence as you can. But I think it all comes down to that preparation, knowing who you're going to be speaking to, knowing the organisation as much as possible and really trying to stay on point.
Yeah, so we're kind of going through a little journey, Scott, if I stick with you here. John Gervais asked the question, what's the first thing you do when you meet a new squad or a team for the first time? Is that, do you basically have to go through this process every single time you've got an international get-together because the players may chop and change? So his question, just to reiterate, is what's the first thing you do when you meet a new squad?
I think we're quite lucky that the squad's usually... there's a big nucleus that's the same, possibly one or two changes every time. I think it's international football with the Scottish FA. It's clear, we have to be clear about the rules, but try to get that balance by delivering the rules in an informal way so that the players don't, it doesn't spoil the experience. I think there's a big responsibility to us to make sure the experience of international football lives up to the billing. You know, these players are coming to represent their country. For a lot of them, it's a real highlight. So it shouldn't be spoiled by the rules. But I think you have to get your rules across, and you have to try and frame the events, the week, so the players know what's coming. But also be yourself and try and influence the team right from the first minute and trying to prepare them for the game. Usually we're preparing for games, so usually don't waste any time and get straight to it on trying to influence the team and really get them together, because obviously you've got players from different clubs. You need to try and get them all on the same page as soon as you can.
Mm-hmm. Michelle, you'd probably be quite similar, I would imagine, with the women's national team.
Yeah, pretty similar. I mean, we have a football blueprint that, you know, cascades down through all the youth squads. So I think firstly, setting collective values, because it's all very well as the manager and the coach to set your own values, but I think you get more buy-in if you allow the players to have a bit of autonomy in that as well. So setting values is huge, but being clear on what the objective is. Obviously, with women's team, it's always about qualification for finals. So be clear on that. It's not an aspirational target, it's that's what you want to try and achieve. And then I think looking at the football blueprint, so how we want to play the game, and looking at, we always talk about the three moments in the game, and if you have a standardised approach, I think that the players obviously can learn better because you're sticking to key themes, but obviously that changes depending on the opponents from a tactical perspective. But I think there's the fundamentals that you put in place, like Scott alluded to, and I think we're very fortunate that we have got a clear kind of progressive system in place for all our national teams that we want to operate within.
Yeah, certainly, Steve, a kind of national association perspective there, but in a club perspective, you take over that new role. Is that your own beliefs? You know, is players there are maybe... or maybe used to one manager and you're getting the job, of course, because maybe the last manager hasn't done so well. How does that change maybe in maybe the roles you've undertaken over the years?
Well, I think if you're going into a club that, you know, that unfortunately somebody's lost their job and you're taking over, I think one of the main things for me was always that it's a clean slate, you know, because there's always been a pattern of who's played. There's maybe people inside the building that hasn't played so much. I think getting across that it's a clean slate is important. If you first of all go into a job, you know, I know it sounds silly, but more of a human one, trying to know everybody's name. Because sometimes if you've went in, you know, to a lower division, or you went into a foreign country, as I've done before, you know, trying to actually connect and get, you know, that on the same wavelength, which I think Scott mentioned and Shelley spoken about as well, where getting everybody on the same page, I think something as simple as trying to get to know everybody's name and then picking out, and then they know that you know them, is, I think, really more of a kind of human thing that seems to connect you with the players straight away. I think that's very important.
Yeah, and that maybe leads us into Lee's question, Steve, if I stick with you, about, you know, the biggest challenges you face when you deal with players. What are the biggest challenges you've probably encountered over the years?
There's been a few, but I mean, one that I've shared with you, you know, and I don't mind sharing it with the candidates today, is, you know, when from above, you know, I had a situation with Michel Salgado when I was at Blackburn, where if he played one more game, he had an automatic one-year extension on his contract that the owners couldn't afford or didn't want to afford. So they told me that I couldn't play him again. Mm-hmm. So that was really tough, because they didn't want me to tell him that it was their decision. So, you know, I slept on it, and then I had to be honest, and I told them, because there's no point in trying to fudge it or paint it a different way. If it's an economic decision that's been made above you, a level where it's a board decision or an owner's decision that affects the players, you have to be honest with them. So I pulled Michelle in. I said, listen, you're not going to play again. They don't want to activate your clause in your contract. I said, listen, go and have a week off, spend some time with your family, and let's work together and try to get you a move. That's what we did. That was really tough.
Yeah. Shelley, biggest challenges when you're maybe dealing with players?
I think as a manager, you're always going to get challenges, because football is based on opinion and it can be very subjective, and you'll always get challenges with certain players. And I guess it's, for me, it's about being honest. People might not like what they hear, but if you're honest and you can give a rationale for your decision making, then I think that you can have a clear conscience. And again, it is about opinion, so you recognise that players won't always agree with you. And there's been many, many, many tough moments, and managers will get tough moments, and it's how you start to be resilient when things happen, because it's never going to be smooth. You've got dealing with the media, dealing with the press when things don't go your way, because, you know, every manager, you can't win every game. And ultimately, you're responsible for that. But I think kind of the initial question, Greg, I think probably one of the hardest things that I've had to deal with is picking the World Cup squad and speaking to the players that didn't go, because it's something that they've dreamed of doing all their lives, and you're the one that's responsible for not picking them. And that was something that was so tough for me emotionally. It was draining. I think, would I do similar? I mean, I made the decision to phone every single player. There was about 30 players I phoned over 2 days. And, you know, some were obviously on cloud nine, and some were what to kill me. So it's that's something that lives with you forever. And it's a tough, tough decision. And it was tough to deal with at the time. It really did affect me emotionally.
Yeah. Yeah, those tough decisions, Scott, that Shelley talks about, and those kind of tough moments, does it become any easier with experience, or once you've maybe been through that, if Shelley was to go through that process again, would it be any easier, or is it just something, as Shelley says, you've got to try and build that resilience and do what you think's right?
Yeah, it's interesting listening to hear Shelley speaking about that. I can relate to that, of course, not under the pressure Shelley has done it, you know, with the senior national team. I've done it with the under-17s, and even at that level, it feels like a big decision. But I think you do learn from it. The 17s were lucky to qualify several times. It obviously helped me, but I think you can times it by 100 when you get to the senior levels that Shelley's working at. So, but I'm sure she would look forward to the challenge of doing it again.
Yeah. And Sergio asks the question as well. What would you say is the hardest part of being a manager, Scott? Is that the hardest part? Is it making those kind of tough decisions on what players are in and what players were out, in and out of squad, never mind in and out of starting 11? Is that the hardest part, or is there another part that's maybe a bit tougher to make decisions?
I've got to be honest, I love it. I had a spell where I was like assistant coach at the national level. I haven't coached at club level, but with the international teams, I had a spell as an assistant coach, but then getting that responsibility of being the head coach, the manager, I really, really enjoyed the change, enjoyed the focus, because obviously it's not just the players, you're dealing with the staff as well. I think it's really important as the head coach, the manager, you're obviously leading and managing the staff as well. But I think it's exciting. I think it really keeps you sharp, and if you love football like we all do, I think you can relish it.
Thinking back to your time as a manager, Steve, is that hardest? What's the hardest part? With Sergio asks his question is, what would you say is the hardest part of being that head coach or manager?
I think for me, more speaking, not so much on an international level like Shelley and Scott, but as a club manager, I think what's very, very difficult, but I've seen it on both sides of the coin, is trying to get the fans, the board and the players on the same page. You know, I was fortunate enough when I was at Fulham, when we had a chairman who was very much in the press, Mohamed Al-Fayed. He owned Harrods, he owned the club. The fans loved him, you know, the players loved him. And, you know, I've seen that side of it. But as a manager, if you find yourself, you know, as a lot of managers do now, where there's new ownership, you know, the fans aren't happy, the players are a bit confused what the owners want. That's a big, big thing that you have to deal with. Can't put that away. That's facing you every single day. So that's a thing that I had at Blackburn, where fans weren't happy with the owners because they weren't putting in money. Players are confused that the owners, what they're actually doing, who's going to stay at the club, who's going to get a new contract, who's moving on. And I think that's the thing that I found very difficult, getting all elements on the same page. And if you can get it like that, your job's so much easier.
Yeah. Shelley, looking back over the years, whether it's Arsenal, University of Stirling, or now the national team, would that be your kind of hardest part, do you think, as well?
Yeah, it would be pretty similar. But do you know what I think is really tough? Because I think there's so much scrutiny that the manager has to put up with. And I think it's about leading yourself, because often you forget about yourself because you're too busy thinking about, if you take national team, for example, you've got the weight of the country on your shoulders. Now you've got the players that you've got, you know, everyone that's the expectations that increase tenfold. But I think it's about leading yourself and managing yourself, because you have so much responsibility. So that's something that I haven't done very well. But now I'm starting to get there whereby, you know, your time management, you know, focus on switching off. I can't emphasise that enough. You know, the guys that are on the course, you know, I'll go on to have careers at various different levels, but you have to be able to switch off because football can consume you. And I would summarise by saying football management, Scott says that he loves his job, we all do, but it's the best and worst job in the world in the same sentence. And it can be, because it's filled with emotions.
Yeah. Yeah, I listened to a Premier League webinar this morning before we came on. There was 500 people on it, and they asked a poll. They did a poll of how many hours each person spends planning their own well-being for the forthcoming week. And it was, you know, I think the answer came out between 40 and 50% was less than 1 hour. And of course, the speaker was then able to speak exactly what you've said, Shelley, that, you know, more time needs to be invested in that to look after yourself to then give of their best. It maybe brings us on, Scott. I'll bring you in at this point. Tony Threlfall's asked a question. How do you make sure you find time to de-stress? Now, Scott, having worked with you for 4 years now, you never seem as if you're that stressed out at any point in time, but do you feel as if you need to put time aside to de-stress, or have you got any mechanisms that you do that might help the guys on the course?
I think it is very important to do that. I think that's proven. Myself, I'm very fortunate. I obviously had my playing experience, which I think was really obviously key to your development. But I think it's important not to get too up when you do well and not to get too down when you don't do well. I'll just try and maintain that evenness. I think your personality does come into that. I'm sure if you speak to a few people who played with me or coached me, they would have probably liked a bit more of, you know, that kind of passion from me. Maybe that was a fault, but maybe in coaching now, hopefully it can be an advantage. As a player, maybe I needed more of it. As a coach, I think it's important to really try and stay focused and like I said, not get too up when you do well and not get too down when you don't.
Yeah, Steve, I've spoke to you podcasts and things maybe before about things like this and your time. I think your answer before was you don't necessarily feel that stress, or you don't feel as if you could reach burnout at any point because you just, similar to Scott, you've got so much passion for the game. But, you know, what other ways might you find time to de-stress and take time out?
Well, I think I'm the same as Scott. I think you... When you love your job and you don't, you know, you get a win, a big win, you know, against a big club, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get another result the next week. So I think it's just having that balance yourself emotionally. And I know it can be difficult. And as well, I never ever used to read, I still don't. I don't read the press too much, you know, because you can be the best manager in the world because you won and the worst manager because you lost. I don't really listen to any type of radio type programs where, you know, fans phone in and stuff, because I think you can get caught up in that. And then the most important thing for me is, you know, you get home after a game, whenever that is, and your family time has to be family time, and make sure best you can not to be talking about football, which is difficult. You know, I think I remember once coming home and my wife sent to me, "Listen, you keep talking about football here. Can I stop being anybody? I'm always Alan Gomer," because Alan Gomer was a player of mine who was having a particular bad time. And I would say, stand up. You'll never guess where it." And she went, "Can I be somebody else apart from Alan Gomer?" And I thought, time to put the ball away, you know.
Enough. Shelley, methods of de-stressing golf course?
Yeah, the last couple of years it has been, I took golf up for that very reason, because somebody said to me, you know, it might help you switch off the football because you do get consumed by it. And I found that because the competitive side of you wants to be good at something, so when you pick up a new skill, you want to try and be good at it. So I found that it's really helped me. Maybe play 7 holes or whatever, and it really does help because I'm concentrating on a new technique, but I'm really competitive, so and that's the downside. But I think Steve made a really good point. To your family and the people that are closest to you, you're just the normal person. You're either a mum, a dad, an uncle, an aunt, a friend, and that's how those people treat you, no, like the manager. And I think it's good to be in that environment, and certainly being around people that are close to you can help you de-stress if you are stressed in the job. And it's so important to be able to put the ball away and just switch off the football, because when you are on it, you need to be on it 100%. So you do need to spend time to relax.
Yeah, good. Looking at maybe switching a little bit now, Scott, and looking at time spent actually in the job and managing. And question from Chris Strain here: what happens when players maybe don't want what you want? How much time and energy do you spend on trying to get them to what Steve Salas was talking about earlier? I suppose how much time and energy do you maybe spend on getting those players to what you want to achieve or what you want to do, maybe in a game plan, or is that the job of maybe your staff that do that, so you don't expend too much time and effort?
I think everybody has to get involved in that situation. I think it's all hands on deck. I think that's where the coach and the staff really earn their money and show their skill, with being able to influence that type of player. We're very lucky, obviously, with the national team. If there was a continual problem, then the player would be changed, because why wouldn't we? We're lucky that we could select somebody else. Obviously, you can't do that at club level, but I think that's the challenge to you as the coach and you as a staff, to be able to influence that player and know how to do it, whether it's visually, whether it's on the pitch, whether it's by talking, whether it's by using somebody else, somebody external possibly, who's specialised in a special way. But you need to work out how you can influence that player and get him on board. And I think that's the real skill of the coach and the challenge to the coach.
Yeah, that real skill that Scott talks about. Shelley, any tips? Maybe Chris has got a couple of problem players at winning Rangers. Any tips that might help him?
Bend them. I'm only kidding. I think there's three things in there, and you probably, I don't know if Brian Howison's been on the course this week, but he talks a lot about leadership. And for me, there's three different pillars of being a manager. So coaching separate, but you've got leadership, and then you've got management, and then you've got being the boss. And I think that firstly, you're looking at that leadership, all the techniques there, and then the management. But if you're giving someone an opportunity to change and they don't, then that's when you've got to be the boss. And as Scott said, you know, there's parameters in place, there's values in place as part of a team. And that one player, if you have one player, it can filter throughout the team. So it's about picking the right moment. And I have to be honest, and I don't know how many people work in the women's game, if any, on the course, but I always find that that's the hard part about working in the women's game or working with female players, because when you make a decision, the team dynamics get affected so negatively, and one decision that you make for one player can filter to maybe three and four players, so it changes the whole dynamics. And again, it's something that can be quite challenging. But I think in the first instance, it's about your leadership skills, management. Then, when it comes to boiling point, you need to be the boss.
Back to you, Steve. You know, those problem players, and maybe how you've dealt with them in the past, or in any way in which you might have, you know, had a specific problem.
Well, I would pick up on and agree with Scott's point. I think it's the whole staff. So, you know, there might be somebody, you know, that's not in the team for one particular game. But then it's about, I think, continuity within your staff. So, for example, at club level, if somebody's not in the team, you know, it's taking the detail of the reserve game, or it's taking the detail of the coach that potentially is taking the Saturday morning session for the guys that's not involved. And then having a bit of continuity, that the ones that are doing well, when there is an opportunity, then you take the advice and you take the real guideline of the person, the staff member that's giving you the feedback, that, listen, this guy is doing great and he's on the fringes, but, you know, he's ready to come back into the squad, or he's ready to play again. I think that makes the whole ethos of your club, that it's an honest environment, that if you work hard and you get on the same page, to answer Chris, you know, get on the bus. If you want to do it, it's a fair environment. If you don't, no problem. We'll help you. We'll actually move it forward, and we'll help you get a move somewhere else, because you want everybody on the same page. To be honest, when, you know, if you're in a caretaker capacity, you know, as I have been before, and there's existing staff there, and you get the job then on a permanent basis, you might inherit staff. And I don't think there's anything up with inheriting staff. Far from it. I had a lot of very good staff members. I think, you know, to echo what Steve Salas said, I think it's about your superpowers. You know, I might be great at something and terrible at something else. So I think making sure that whatever's required at that club, making sure that the skill set of the whole staff tick all the boxes. So you might employ an assistant or a first team coach. It's something that you don't find is your superpower. So I've done a bit of both. I've inherited, I've taken some different staff just because the actual job when you get inside a club is a little bit different to the job before.
Yeah. Scott, would you go along with that? Your staff, maybe just now at under 21s, are these guys that have maybe different strengths to doing your own offering, and maybe coming back to Steve Salas again, who spoke to us about, you know, that for self-awareness?
Yeah, for sure. I think obviously with the younger age groups that I've been working with, is the key objective is to develop the players and push them towards the full squad. So I think it's really important, obviously, to have the staff that can help do that in every area. And whether it's the technical staff or the medical staff, that's the objective for everybody. So I think it's heavily weighted for us with the younger age groups to really pick staff that can help develop the players and push them towards the full squad.
Yeah, I think I would go along with the guys as well, though. I think I've been in a position that I've done both. I've inherited staff, and then, but I think, obviously, Andy, I'd worked with him before, and I want someone that's going to disagree with me and challenge me, because I think that you've more scope to come to the right decision when you've got someone looking at all the different scenarios when you make a decision. So as a collective, you can get to the right point. So I know that Andy will do that. I know he'll challenge me every step of the way, whether it's about team selection, whether it's about training content. And I think that's important. But I think when you're thinking about staff, there's key things that I think you need to look at is trust. You need to be able to trust them, confidentiality, and expertise. So there's three things that I think I would look for in staff.
Tough. Okay, moving on to a question from Tony McParland here. It's a long question, so bear with me here. Do you focus more on physical attributes rather than technical ability? Nurture players and focus extra development on them to give the national team something that we haven't had in a long time? Here's a question. So I think he's asking more, should we look maybe more for players that can affect, can score goals, create goals and carry a real threat? I'm not sure there's a question in there or if Tony's just making a statement, but we'll try and make it into a question as best we can. So I'll try and make it into a question in my way then. Do we need a blend of players? Do we need, you know, some steady eddies alongside some real mavericks? Is that the best way to try when maybe you're picking a team, Shelley?
I think you need balance. Balance is the most important thing in a team. We want players that will buy into the blueprint but are also able to execute the different skills criteria that we put in that blueprint, whether it's from a tactical perspective or technical. But if you talk about the four pillars of development, Greg, I think they're all equally important. You know, the physical element, you can be the most talented player, but if you can't run and you can't, you know, play an intensity at the highest level, and it's the same as the mental side. If you can't cope with the pressure and make decisions under pressure at the highest level, then you won't be successful. So, but I have to be honest, we are very, very process-driven rather than outcome. Even although we're at the top level and we want 3 points, we want to develop winners, but we want to play the game in the right way. So there is an element of that process, but we haven't an end product there in the type of football that we play. And it's, for me, it's about getting the balance right. So you don't compromise, obviously, winning the game because you're in a qualification campaign, and you don't want that to be at the detriment of, obviously, developing those other aspects. But we're very, very focused on our youth national teams of developing this football blueprint, because ultimately we want sustainable success. So when the players that are in the national team now retire, we need to make sure that there's a conveyor belt and a depth of talent that can be successful in the future. So it's important that within that blueprint, you've got a style, a system, you've got a framework, but you've also got adaptability and flexibility in there as well. So that's key for us.
Yeah. Scott, Shelley mentioned the conveyor belt, and you've done really well in recent years from the under 21s. There's a lot of players taking that step up to the national team, but I'm sure you still try and get 3 points on the board as well during the competitive fixture. So how does all that balance up when you're maybe picking a squad alongside what Tony's maybe alluded to, and how you pick the players that best fit that squad?
Yeah, I agree with some great points from Shelley there. Listening to you now, speaking now, I think something I'm very conscious of is giving the opportunity to as many of our best young players as possible, giving that experience to them. I think it's, no matter how experienced you are, it's very, very difficult to predict which players are going to push through to the full squad. There are some obvious ones. Billy Gilmore, obviously, at the moment would fit that bill, but on the whole, it's very hard to predict. So I think it's important that we give the experience and opportunity to as many of our good players as possible to really help maximise their potential. I think for me, that's the bottom line. That's our job, to help every player maximise their potential.
Yeah. Steve, you've had the role before as head of academy at a few clubs, and obviously being a first team manager as well as then being recruitment director recently. So, you know, that very phrase of Scott's there, it's difficult to predict which players will make that step up. Is there, you know, how have you overseen that transition in all those different jobs?
Well, I would agree with Scott and Shelley, where I think trying to have within your framework a process that helps the individual mature, you know, when you're an academy director or you're an assistant coach and you're trying to get this young group to come through, I think it's important that you've got some type of framework where it's about the individual. I would also add that as they get up closer to the first team, you know, and that becomes then more of results, then, you know, you want to be able to teach them how to win, but you want them also to know how to win, but how to accept defeat, you know, and how to take the game in the right way as a young player. You know, I've been fortunate enough to have many, many good young players coming through and try to get that balance of pushing them in to the first team environment and making sure that they're emotionally ready, because as soon as they go in there, you know, and they've got to maybe play and get 3 points for the manager and for the club, you have had to have touched on teaching them how to win and how to deal with defeat. So I think it's a part of their development, trying to teach them that aspect of how to deal with things.
Yeah. Question coming in here from Sean Rowland. Shelley, how do you ensure that you grow and improve? Where and how do you learn? Do you have any certain ways of developing yourself other, obviously, than qualifications?
Well, I think it's key after every game, after every training session. We record everything, so it's about looking back and looking at the things that went well, the things that you think you could do different, and that takes real critique. You have to have a self-awareness and have good mentors that are going to tell you the truth, and, you know, read, be open-minded to learning. But I think the biggest thing is being really critical of yourself and having a self-awareness. So for me, that should be a fundamental at the highest level of every manager and coach, that you actually critique what you're doing on a regular basis. You know, and it's always, I think there's a saying, what got you here won't get you there. So you've always got to be proactive in developing and learning yourself, because nobody in this world, whether you're a coach or a manager at any level, is a finished article.
No. Steve, coach, manager, head of recruitment, you know, how do you grow and improve through those different roles?
I think you accept, Greg, no matter what age you are or where you are in your career, then you're like, I totally agree with Shelley, you self-critique and you're never the finished article. You know, I look at guys like Roy Hodgson, for example, and I listen to him and I watch him. You know, I've been fortunate enough to see him up close and personal on many occasions delivering sessions. The enthusiasm to learn, you know, in his age, he's in his, I think he's in his 70s now, Roy. Mm-hmm. And you look at him and he knows that he's still learning. And I think we all are, we never stop. And I think, you know, analysing your session, analysing your decisions, having staff round about you, which I think Shelley's touched on, that are going to be honest with you. You critique yourself. But when I was in an assistant role, you know, you maybe try and have a staff member that's giving you the second right answer, as I like to call it. Something's not worked. Substitution's not worked. You want somebody to say, well, listen, what about this? What about that? And I think you're always learning. You can go back and you can look at games where, you know, you've got results. Great. Probably more of a learning aspect is the ones where you've not got results. Why did you not get them? Looking back over the week. And if you had to replay the week again, what you would do different. It's just that, you know, always reflecting, always learning, always trying to improve.
Yeah. Scott, are you the same? I know you and I spend several hours together, maybe planning Pride Labs and things like that, which help, I suppose, other people go through the process of growing and improving. But how do you maybe go about it yourself?
Yeah, I think you have to be conscious of it. I think, like Shelley says, you have to be proactive and really make it happen, surround yourself with the right people. But inside you, you have to be conscious of it and have that kind of professional ambition to get better and find ways to do it. It's about making it personal and really finding a way. There's obviously lots and lots of different ways you can do it, but I think you have to have it inside you. You have to really be conscious of it.
Yeah. And then a follow-up question from Sean, which he's just put in here recently, is once you've learned that something new, how do you assess that you've changed it or it's a good thing to implement in your coaching? Is that maybe back to what Shelley says, Scott, that ability, you have the ability as well when you're working with the 21s to record things and to have that self-reflection and chat to staff?
Yeah, we do. I think we're obviously very lucky. With the 21s that we can do that. We've got great facilities with enough staff to do that. But and it's very important not only that to use that for the players but for the staff as well, myself included. I think, like Shelley says, it's important that it happens on a daily basis. But there's, I think you'll struggle to find anyone who doesn't learn from watching themselves back, watching the session. You've got to keep asking yourself why. I think it's very important when you're designing your practices, but also reviewing the practices, you know, asking the question why.
Yeah. There's a good one to pick up on, Shelley, just that very question. I'm just trying to find who asked it. Luke Middlewick asked it. What is your why? Why are you involved? You know, that book by Simon Sinek, you know, what's your why? Why are you involved? Why are you the women's team national manager?
Easy. It's an easy one because never ever forget why you get involved in football. I kicked the ball when I was 3-4 years old because I had a passion for it, and I've still got the same passion, even more because it develops over the year. And no matter what level you're at, whether you're a volunteer as a coach or whether you get paid to be a coach, whether it's a junior game, a women's game, men's game, club, national team, it doesn't matter. You're in it because you're passionate about sport. But ultimately, for me, my motivation is I want to help people. That's what you are as a coach and a manager. You're a leader. You want to help people. You want to develop people. And I have a real desire and confidence to make decisions to help those people. Now, everyone will argue, do you get it right all the time? You don't. Absolutely not. But that is my passion. And that's what motivates me. And football, for me, is the most emotional game in the world. Makes you cry, it makes you laugh. There's so many emotions, and I wouldn't have it any other way. And that's my motivation to be a manager and a coach.
Yeah. Steve, I'm pretty sure you're pretty much the same to that.
Yeah, I would echo what Shelley says. You know, when we were all players, you know, that's all you could think about was you playing. Then when that comes to an end and you start doing your coaching licenses, it blows your mind a little bit initially, because you're not only just looking at from your eyes, you're now starting to think as a coach. And then if you're fortunate enough to get into a position where you can see young, you know, I think most of us have started with young players in a development programme, starting to see those players improve, and you feel that you can do that, you can help players and people improve. And then, you know, you've got the tactical side, which I think we all find fascinating. I think we're all football watchers. As one of the outside tutors said, I think, last week, we love watching all sorts of games. And if you think you can formulate a game plan and you find yourself quite good at it and you can improve players, it gives you that, you know, that second best feeling from playing, which is coaching. I think coaching becomes an extension of when the legs don't run any longer.
Yeah. Scott, what about yourself? That, just picking up on what Steve said again, that transition from being a player to a coach, how's that been for you? And do you enjoy coaching more, or was it, or do you still miss the playing days?
It's a good question. I don't think I do. I didn't think I was going to miss football. I played at a good level. I think I played at a good level, but I didn't consider myself a very famous player. I lived a normal life. I didn't get recognised in the street. I didn't think I'd miss football, but I did. And if you'd asked me when I made that transition to coaching, why'd I want to do it? My answer would have been purely football. I love football. But now, years later, I would, of course, football without a doubt. But I would add to that, me personally, I love what Shelley's spoken about earlier about management, about leadership, about coaching, developing myself and learning those skills, because I think they are skills that you do learn and you have to continually improve. I would add them to my love of football now. I really enjoy the process.
Yeah. Ricky's come in with a question. Ricky Wellard's come in with a question. Shelley, do the best managers lead by love or fear, or a combination of both? Now, this was something we spoke about earlier on with Steve Salas, and he put love on one end of the axis, if you like, and fear on the other end of the axis, and you can only maybe have that little bit of fear and rule by fear if you show your players enough love so that the two of them balance out. Are you conscious of that throughout your time being a head coach?
I think that, again, it's about balance. I would never use the word fear about anything. I think there's apprehension there always, but as a manager, I think the hard part is that when a game's gone or a moment's gone, then you're thinking about always what's next. So there is a passion. I speak about want to help people, because that's your job as a manager, regardless of the business you're in, whether it's sport, whether it's, you know, productivity elsewhere, whether it's just business. You're a teacher as a coach, but you're also a leader in that management job. So I wouldn't use the word fear, but I think the big thing is about you're a manager because you want to be successful. You want to help people become successful. So there is an element of apprehension when it doesn't go well, but you recognise that in sport in particular, it's such a competitive environment that you cannot account for things that can happen all the time. So that's why I'm big on process, because you have to have a system in place that you operate within, because you can't control everything. But again, I would emphasise the fact that, you know, being a manager, you have to have all this different criteria. You have to learn about leadership. You have to learn about every single person in this world is unique and how you get the best out of them. And you have to be really composite of your tactical knowledge of football. And all those things you can develop every day in life.
Steve, you'd go along with that, I would imagine.
Yeah, I would. And I would certainly echo what Shelley said, and I don't think that you lead by fear. I think maybe a lot of years ago there was that in football where there was fear, I think now I would swap the word fear for respect. You know, I think it's the easier end of the spectrum is the love part, because, you know, it's easier to give that out. But at the other end, if you're leaving players out, I don't think they can be fearful of you. I think they just have to have a respect element that it's not personal. It's that this is, you've not been selected. Respect the decision. Respect your teammates. You'll get another opportunity because it's a fair environment, and you'll get another go. And when you get another go, if you're selected again, you go again. If not, somebody else is going to feel like that. So I would swap fear for respect. And I think as long as you're consistent, you know, you're keeping, I think, 99.9% of the players, you know, on side.
Yeah. Scott, it must be even more difficult when the players aren't yours, in effect. You know, you're borrowing the players, if you like, from clubs, and you've only got them for a short space of time. You need to get, you need to get quick buy-in to try and get results. So, you know, you've got less time to lead through fear, probably, just to pick up again on our earlier chats on leadership with Steve.
Yeah. We're obviously very lucky. When they come to play, they come really motivated. They want to play. They're delighted they've been selected. So that obviously gives us a big boost. Just quickly, speaking about, you know, the manager, I think there's been a big push in recent years regarding soft skills for management in football. I think if you look at Klopp and Guardiola, their players want to play for them, in my opinion. I obviously haven't been working with those guys, but to me, looking from the outside, the players want to play for them. And for me, I can really relate to that. You know, I was lucky to play for Brian Clough. I heard everybody says, you know, what was Brian Clough's X factor? And it's hard to really say that as an ex-player, but I heard Martin O'Neill speaking once. It was actually when Mr. Clough passed away, but he was on stage and he said, you know, this is Martin speaking. He said, "What people ask me, what was Clough's X factor?" And Martin actually said, "You wanted to play for him." And when Martin said that, it really resonated with me as an ex-player of Brian Clough's. And I think I can see that in the top managers now. I think the soft skills really, really crucial to the manager getting that emotional in the performance, where you can see the team are all aligned, but they're playing for the manager. I think that's the real challenge to try to get there.
Yeah, it was a question that came up last week, Shelley, the best manager or best coach you've maybe ever played with. If Scott's maybe alluding to Brian Clough there, is there anybody that jumps out in your playing career or somebody you've learned a lot from?
Lots of people, I think. You take little bits and you adapt things. You think there's things that you like and things that you don't like. But I have to say, but my time as a national team player, Anna had done a great job of building confidence in players. But before that, it was Vera Pauw who, for me, was her tactical knowledge was absolutely phenomenal in attention to detail. And as much as her man management skills left a lot to be desired at times because of her approach, I think tactically she was fantastic. So it's just a wee example. You maybe take that element and then another element from another manager. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think what you have to be mindful of is that as a manager, there'll be always players that don't like your approach and your technique. And that's just life. And I think Steve alluded to it earlier. You can't afford to take things too personally. But I've been really fortunate that I've had a lot of good people that have been instrumental in helping me on and off the pitch. And I think Scott mentioned, obviously, Mr. Clough, as he calls him, because he holds him in such high regard.
Yeah.
But I think there's people out with football that can help you because there's so many transferable skills. And I think Scott mentioned soft skills. That's where we're at now in management. I think the best managers have the best soft skills.
Yeah. There we go, Steve, then. You know, coach and manager, very two different roles, probably, as Shelley alludes to there. So, best coach you've ever had, best manager you've ever had, bits and bobs from different people.
Yeah, I would agree with Scott and Shelley. I think you take bits, you know, as a young player when I was at Celtic, Billy McNeil was a manager, you know, big leader, you know, massive amount of respect. And then for the younger guys that we were in, you know, find myself, Jimmy Johnston and Bobby Lennox, two like legendary players, but, you know, all they wanted to do was to give you everything, all their experiences to push you on and push you up the ladder. So, you know, I still think about those young, you know, those coaches I had when I was young. And then, like Shelley says, sometimes when you become a young coach or a player and you mix with different people, it's sometimes seen not how to do it. And then you just try and put it all together and become the best you, because you don't want, you know, I think it's been said last week by somebody on the course, you want to be the best you.
Yeah,
the best you, and not, you know, you're not the second best, whoever, you know, be the best you can be by all your experiences and being you. You know, that's the players, you want to get them to play for you, but I think you get that with being yourself.
Scott, just last couple of minutes just to finish up, and the question I always like to finish with is probably that little bit of advice, having worked with A-licensed candidates now for the past 2 weeks and hopefully seeing them back in the future now that they've started on the A-licensed course. What's kind of the words of wisdom or words of advice you would give them at this stage?
Keep going. I think you've got to get out there. I know it's difficult with the restrictions right now, but as soon as the restrictions are lifted, then get back on the grass. And working with the groups this week, it seems to be a huge variation in experience. Some people have been coaching for 25 years, some are right at the beginning of their pathway, but just get back out there. And I think it's whether you're making that transition. I can obviously relate to the players who are making that transition from player to coach. And it does take time, and you do have to force it, and you do have to change your mentality. The way you watch games changes, but you have to really push to make that change.
Yep. Brilliant, Steve.
Yeah, I'd echo what Scott said. I think now what we've done as a federation with this resource, you know, for the candidates that's on the course to go back onto all the things that they've picked up, you know, and a lot of it's there for them to re-examine, you know, to go through all the notes, you know, get it all down, and then just look forward to being able to, you know, take that forward when we get on the pitch. But it's like you said at the start, Greg, you know, we've got, think of the, within all the group, how many, you know, what type of experience. I don't just mean the staff, I mean the candidates themselves. It's just learning from each other. And you know, never think you're the finished article. We're all still developing.
Yeah, absolutely. Shelley, finish with you. Have you got the 10-point plan ready to roll out again?
I mean, stimulate and challenge the players, keep things fresh, develop a playing philosophy. These are more generic, you know, sell your vision by using your expertise and your experience, gain experience. Have a game plan, always make it clear, give the players clarity. Know your own strengths and know people around you's strengths and weaknesses, that's important. Have a hunger, desire and intelligence to develop yourself. Can't emphasise this one enough. Critique yourself to the max, because it's the only way that you'll learn. Have open communication and enjoy. Reflect and get ready to go again, because that's what happens in football.
Super. Guys, thanks very much for that past hour. That was very insightful. I'm sure the guys will agree. So thanks again for your time.